In this portion of the program, creating beautiful, easy care organic gardens. Our guest is one of the country's leading garden experts, Anne Lovejoy. Anne Lovejoy is an award-winning garden writer who has gardened around the world. She lectures frequently on the art, philosophy, techniques, and pleasures of sustainable gardening and lawn care. Lovejoy is the author of more than 18 gardening books. Her latest is titled Anne Lovejoy's Organic Garden Design School, a guide to creating your own beautiful, easy care garden. A frequent guest on radio and television, she is a regular garden and food columnist for the Seattle Post-Intelligencer. She is also the founder and director of the Sequoia Center for the Healing Arts. It is the site of her home and garden. And she has a public volunteer gardening project that transforms neglected public spaces into thriving gardens. That project is called The Town in Bloom. Listeners, I invite your questions on gardening for Anne Lovejoy. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Anne Lovejoy's Organic Garden Design School is published by Rodale. Anne Lovejoy, good afternoon. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Tell us more about The Town in Bloom.
Oh, it's my favorite project. We started at the library, which had built on a big addition but had no money at all for landscaping, and it's about an acre and a half site, and it was pretty neglected. So we decided, a bunch of us decided to create a walking book, kind of like there's talking books for the blind. We thought there should be a walking garden book there you could walk through and see what would be appropriate in our region, all kinds of ways to treat different kinds of sites, because there's a lot of difficult problems on the site. And it's totally volunteer, all donated materials, and it's absolutely beautiful. In fact, we won the Best Garden Library Garden in the Country Award last year from Story Publishing.
Oh, congratulations.
It's pretty fun.
Yeah. Have other communities shown an interest in The Town in Bloom, and is this something that's being adopted around the country?
Yes, actually, we have started working with a number of other library groups specifically, but also some just town groups, because we do work in all over the place downtown in sort of abandoned corners making mini parks. And what I try to do is create a friends group for each area. So there's a band of loyal volunteers that really care about that corner and are there year-round. It's pretty neat.
Yeah. At the outset of your new book, you say humans grow best when in close contact with plants and natural communities. What led you to that insight?
Well, historically, it's kind of obvious that, you know, as human beings developed, we didn't have condos and cars. We were right out there in the, you know, we were maybe in caves or huts or whatever, but we were obviously in a great deal more close contact. And there have been a number of studies, quite interesting studies, showing that physiologically we respond very well to being around plants. In fact, some studies show that if you're sitting in an office looking out at a parking lot, it doesn't change your stress level at all. But if you're looking out at a park, you will actually have measurable physiological reduction of stress. And, of course, if you're in that park, it's even greater response. And, interestingly, a park-like environment creates a stronger stress reduction response than a tidy, clipped, formal kind of garden. It's interesting.
Hmm. And plants, too, you say, are social. You want to explain that?
Well, yeah. If you look almost anywhere you go, actually any kind of habitat at all that supports plants, you'll find certain kinds of relationships being echoed over and over. Of course, they are shaped partly by climate, rain distribution, wind, and so forth, but always there is essentially a tree line or canopy, and there's high and low understory, and then there's a carpeting layer. And sometimes those layers are dwarfed by, as I say, environmental effects, but always you see anywhere the same kind of basic relationships echoed. And so when we bring those into the garden, we create a natural-looking space that puts plants in their proper environmental niche, which means they just grow better.
Hmm. So think of the garden as a three-dimensional space, not a two-dimensional space.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Your garden contains, I understand, thousands of plants. How much space does it take up?
Well, my current garden, I've had quite a lot in the last number of years, but my current garden is on a three-quarter acre site, but there's a house and parking lots for my school and quite a large school building. It's a very big building, actually. And so probably it's only, oh gosh, it's hard to say, maybe there's a quarter of an acre that's really in gardens, and each one is separate and each one has its own specific problem to solve, essentially, because one of the things I try to do is rather than really change the site a whole lot, I work with it. So if I have a boggy area, I create a bog garden. And if I have a hot, dry southwest exposure, I plant things that love that kind of condition rather than trying to alter it. Even when I have poor soil, I can find plants that actually thrive in poor soil and don't even want rich soil. It's kind of neat. So instead of going after it as a problem, you kind of attack the solution by addressing the fact that you have certain things, and so you go with that condition. You go with what works for that condition instead of trying to alter everything.
Yeah, go with Mother Nature rather than fight her.
It's so much easier.
How much time does it require to maintain your gardens?
The gardens that I develop, I try to create gardens that basically need us less and less as time goes by because I'm getting older, and I think that's just a really practical way. So I rely on a kind of a woody matrix, trees and shrubs that are site adaptive and correctly sized for my site so that I don't have to engage in a whole lot of repetitive chores. In fact, my book is very much about eliminating repetitive chores like clipping, trimming, edging, weeding, watering as much as possible. So you're creating as a sort of sustainable society of plants, right? A relationship between the plants, putting them where they like to be. And so that reduces the amount of time that I have to put in. Most of the time, it's intensive up front, like with any good garden, where you're involved in creating wonderful dirt the best you can, making good prep, doing the best things you can do for your plants up front. But once they're established, I don't have to water except once or twice in the summer. I don't weed hardly ever. If you're weeding, you don't have enough plants. I don't have to feed my plants except twice a year when I put down heavy feeding mulches. So what I do a lot of is kind of walking through and looking, oh, it's beautiful, and maybe deadheading a little. I use a lot of what I call chop-and-drop method, so I'm mulching, composting right on site, dropping things where they lie, and they can just rot down right there instead of lugging most of it away. So I get a lot of pleasure from my garden, but I don't work very hard.
Boy, that sounds great.
It is great.
What is the point of entry to your garden like?
Well, actually, there are several, and that's a little tricky because it's a public access area, and I do have about 100 people a day coming through here, it needs to look really good even if I'm in Alaska or something. So that's part of why I go for this independent matrix of plants. But the main entry, actually, you come up some shallow steps that are created out of recycled lumber, and all my curving, beautiful walls are made out of recycled loading docks that were in the back, so they're concrete, but they're trimmed with a stone chisel, so they look like cut stone, and most people think they're dressed stone. And we made sinuous curving walls instead of straight ones, and then planted a lot of things into the chinks. Anytime there's a place where nature's going to put a plant, I think you're smart to get your own plants in there first. So I carefully planted the wall with a lot of native things that love those kind of nooks and crannies and do well in walls. So you come in, and there's big, shallow, curving paths that pull your eye toward where I want you to go and take it away from where I don't want you to go. So I can direct the eye by using a soft curve. Straight lines are very martial and military. They march you. But a soft curve pulls you, and you can achieve the same thing. You can actually have your direct line with a soft S and never lose sight of your target, but the soft S makes you slow down and feel leisurely.
Now, I have a problem in my yard with this because the yard is long and narrow, and the house is also quite rectangular in the same direction. How can I soften those angles and make the yard curvy?
Well, one of the things you want to think about is, like, if you were a river, where would you run? And making soft paths, I've seen, one of my friends has an incredibly cool garden, but it's only 25 feet wide and 160 feet long, so it's a Band-Aid. And what she did is use very narrow plants for the most part and did a central bed of trees and shrubs and side beds of trees and shrubs that are all pretty much understory things, and so she's borrowing her tree line from the neighbors. So all the biggest things come on somebody else's property, and you're allowed to use those for free. And because her central path isn't straight but curving, the beds sort of open and close and swell and pull you in these curves. And when you're in this garden, you really don't realize how narrow and constricted it actually is. And I think that's brilliant because it does break the box completely. And when we remember that we can use other people's big plants, we're not using up our own space on a few huge trees that really eat the yard.
Flow is important to you, and I imagine those curves help flow a great deal.
Very much, yeah. One of the things you want to do is pull the eye and foot, but with a little mystery. There's no incentive to march down a long straight path when you can see the end of it, unless there's something really intriguing there, but even then you just turn around and march back. But if it's soft and curvy and you have a little element of mystery, you're not quite sure what's behind that next corner, it really is very inviting, and it gives you the sense that the space is bigger than it really is.
The title of your new book includes the words organic garden design. What is that? And then also, side by side with that question, you call yourself a naturalistic gardener. What does it mean to be a naturalistic gardener?
Well, and those are very related questions, of course. I call it naturalistic because I'm really echoing planting patterns of the natural habitats all over the world. In other words, the canopy, the high-low understory, and the furnishing layer. Many gardens just have like a hedge and a furnishing layer, so they don't have the natural topography that you see in natural plant communities. But when we echo those lines, those layers, a couple different things happen. One, it becomes a ton easier to take care of because woody plants, if they're properly chosen and well-placed, once they're established, which is 2 or 3 years of watering for trees, maybe 2 years for shrubs, they're really relatively independent and they don't need you. They don't need very much from you, which is great, and they just keep on doing what they do. I try to go for perimeter plantings that offer spring flowers or maybe summer fruit, fall color, and beautiful winter skeletons, and I use a mix of conifers and deciduous. About a third evergreens gives you lots of structure without making the feeling that something is too static. And I look at the mixed woods, the deciduous and hardwoods and evergreens mixed together, and take that pattern and see how that makes a great background. And if you think ahead and choose plants that are the right size, you're not engaging in that kind of chainsaw relationship where we keep trying to make something that wants to be, for instance, a boxwood typically would be 15 feet high and across, but we want them to be a 3 foot wide rectangle, 6 feet long. That's really a chainsaw relationship, right? But if we choose those things properly, we engage nature and employ plants for what they actually do well, then we're not fighting it all the time. And that's sort of the naturalistic thing of putting plants in their proper ecological niche, giving them the right kinds of friends and relatives. And I also, I guess I say organic natural design. Organic garden design is using natural systems, using what works, gardening where you are, using plants that love the water distribution that occurs naturally in your region. So I usually start with natives, and I call it natives and allies, because you can also, for instance, I'm in the Pacific Northwest now, and we have native rhododendrons, but I can also grow rhododendrons from Asia with a similar climate zone, and they love it here. I have many native maples, so I can bring in Japanese maples. They'll also do well. I have, you know, native coral bells, and I can pull in all those gorgeous coral bells from all over the place and use them in a similar environmental niche, and they'll do just fine. So by calling in plants that are related to or very like our own natives, we can do the matrix of natives and then embroider on that base. And organic design is really about, it's not static, it's not creating an outdoor room and having it be the same for the rest of my life, but it's assembling a collection of plants that will grow up together and that alter together over time. The way you learn how to do this is by making a whole lot of mistakes. I mean, it took me years to come to this, and I really spent a lot of time studying European gardens, wild gardens, formal gardens, all kinds of systems, and looking at how, what they're based on and how they work. And one of the things I really realized about much European and English design is historically it was very much based on the hand of man and interference with the natural, and actually designed in opposition to the natural. Most of those great gardens deliberately hedge out or fence out these gorgeous rolling hillsides that we would probably want to pull into our gardens and create view corridors for. But it was about setting a place apart from nature. And it was also a way of showing how wealthy you were, that the more control that was necessary, clipped parterres and boxwood, that meant you were wealthy and you could employ a lot of people.
Interesting. Have you always been an organic farmer?
Oh, yeah.
Organic grower?
Yes, absolutely.
Gardener?
Since I was in high school, yeah. First of all, I was a teenager in the 60s. So that whole sort of green revolution of organic growing, that was something that I picked up on very early and felt always very at home with. I never liked the idea of chemical warfare on plants on the natural world. And now, of course, with even the EPA stepping in and saying that's right, that most garden chemicals are unsafe for children and pets, the incidences of cancers and other kinds of environmentally caused long-term diseases is very high when people are using a lot of agricultural chemicals or garden chemicals. So it makes real sense to try to create sustainable garden designs that can be maintained completely with natural care.
Mm. What do you do, though, with well, one of the things I'm sure that you do is you crowd out weeds with the plants that you want to have, and mulch and that kind of thing. But what about pests like the Japanese beetle, rabbits, slugs?
How do I deal with those things?
Yeah,
it's kind of fun. My garden is right butts onto a grand forest, a forest reserve of several hundred acres. So I often have six or eight deer in the garden every day. And I try to work with the fact that they are going to eat certain things, that we've displaced a lot of habitat for them. One way I utilize the deer is that in front of my home I had an area where the planning committee told me I needed to have a 6 or 8 foot hedge, and the police told me it couldn't be more than 3 feet tall. Well, that's two public people telling me that I have to do something. So what I did is plant native red twig dogwood, which the deer really love. Technically, it will grow 8 feet, but the deer keep it to about three. So everybody's happy with that solution. Mm. But really, also, I've found that if I plant a lot of things in variety, for instance, they love dogwoods, but I have probably 15 kinds of dogwoods, so they'll eat some of each maybe, or most of one year and another and not. And I find part of that is just the abundance theory, that there's always enough. I do a lot of modeling by looking at natural systems. I spent many years kind of hiking around in wilderness areas looking at these incredible mountain meadows and realizing every month if you hike to the same area, you know, month after month, you'll notice a whole sequence of plants. One month it's all white and yellow, then you come back and it's all blue, later it's rosy, and all these plants are coming up, doing their thing, dying back, and it always looks great. And I thought, who mulched here last? Who deadheaded? Who watered? Nobody. These natural systems, prairies, plains, meadows, are maintaining themselves by self-mulching. And I started to do some work and research and realized that underground, there were well-knit matrices of roots. So if you were to take prairie sod, for instance, and cut down, you will see this web of roots that weaves together, and it's very sustainable, but there's not much room for invaders. So an undisturbed prairie is an area that you won't see a lot of, like, invasive Euro trash weeds, you know, invasion weeds from other countries in there. But in disturbed areas, that's where the weeds come in. And so as soon as we disturb a natural environment, we lose the protection of that web of underground roots. But we can kind of recreate that concept in our own gardens by using cooperative plants that are site-adaptive, that like to be in the kind of conditions we offer, placing them close enough so that at maturity they lap each other, but they're not too crowded. And underground, the roots will echo what's on top of the ground.
Yeah.
And when the web is tight, there's no space for invaders.
Yeah. You write in the book about thinking of this as a sandwich.
Yeah. In other words, thinking about cubic gardening instead of just square foot gardening. What's going on under the soil? And you can have, for instance, a whole sequence of bulbs from crocus and snowdrops through lilies or gladiolas or whatever you want, all through, you know, beautiful ornamental onions and things that will bloom and die back in sequence, sheltered with a few perennials to hide the foliage as it fades. And when you make that kind of sandwich underground, layering the plants into the earth so that the deepest ones are planted maybe 12 inches down and then 8 and 5 and 4, and the perennials weave between them, those systems mimic natural systems, meadow systems, where the plants all do sort of sequence each other in and out. And it really looks quite beautiful. And again, you have to play around and you have to make some mistakes to make it work.
Yeah. What have been some of the worst mistakes you've made over the years?
Well, it's hard to say, because when you plant things that are overly enthusiastic, I mean, you learn so much by doing it wrong. I learn way more by making mistakes. You don't even notice when you do it right. It goes, you sort of say, well, that goes well, that looks great. And that's the end of the story. But when something doesn't work, then you really dog at it and really work at it till you figure out why not. One of the things I have learned is not to employ ground covers that are too vigorous, because they become bad masters and poor servants. They're doing their job way too well and interfering with others. So I really started looking for plants that are cooperators, that are don't need too much. They're not prima donnas. They share resources well. It's like the kind of people you'd like to work with, you know? And those are the kind of plants I try to bring into the garden and try to really suit them in sort of vigor and in nutritional draw on the soil, so that you get to develop these nice matrices of plants that really do well together in concert. And the worst mistakes have involved underestimating somebody's spreadability, say, or forgetting in the beginning, for instance, I didn't always think about how big things were going to get because most books don't really talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
And what they assume is that you'll just get your chainsaw out and start whacking away at it. But I want to create a matrix that doesn't need to be whacked. And so that taught me to pay a lot more attention to the ultimate size in my region. And you can't always rely on garden books. A lot of garden books list you sort of the vague, this is the mature size, but where are we talking about? Chicago, Boston, New York, Florida? The plant might grow in all those places, but you can bet it's not going to be the same size in all those places. So you need to really look at local arboreta and parks, private and public gardens, and get a sense of what things look like in maturity so that you can really say, wow, that thing's huge, and it's only 15 years old, according to the owner. Maybe I don't want two of them planted right next to my driveway or sidewalk. Mm-hmm. Maybe I'll put them back 10 feet. You see?
Yeah. Have you ever had to do whacking?
Oh, absolutely. I work with a group called Plant Amnesty, and they are protecting the plants and trying to stop tree topping and inappropriate pruning. And we actually do big classes. We go into the most overgrown gardens we can find that have been let go for years where everything is totally out of control. And then we do restorative pruning. Sometimes we resort to shovel pruning, which means you start pruning at the ground and you dig a hole and take that plant right out. Sometimes that's the only thing to be done. But a lot of times, big shrubs that are totally too fat for the yard can be treated like a small tree, and you lift their skirt. And in my book, I do show how you do this. You turn a big shrub into a delicate small tree that might be quite beautiful.
We're going to pause here, and I'm going to bring our listeners some weather information. The National Weather Service in Lincoln has issued a severe thunderstorm warning for DeWitt County in central Illinois and Macon County in central Illinois until 2:15 this afternoon at 1:25. National Weather Service Doppler radar indicated a line of severe thunderstorms from Waynesville to Blue Mound, or from 9 miles northwest of Clinton to 12 miles northeast of Taylorville, moving east at 40 miles per hour. Damaging winds in excess of 60 miles per hour will accompany this dangerous storm. Go to a basement or an interior room on the lowest floor of a sturdy building. Abandon cars and mobile homes if you are in the warned area. A severe thunderstorm warning for DeWitt and Macon counties in central Illinois until 2:15 this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. We're talking this afternoon about sustainable gardening, beautiful, easy care organic gardens. Our guest is Anne Lovejoy. She's one of the country's leading garden experts. She's the author of more than 18 gardening books. Her latest is Anne Lovejoy's Organic Garden Design School, a guide to creating your own beautiful, easy care garden. Listeners, I invite your comments and questions this afternoon. Join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. And back to those big overgrown yards that you conquer with your friends. What if someone is out there listening to us now who has a property and they're looking at a major overhaul of a space and they're on a budget and maybe there's only a couple of people, you know, in the house that can really get out there and work it? How do you start to think about taming or not taming? Maybe that's the wrong word to use with you, but, you know, getting that space shaped up.
Well, I actually have a whole section in the book called Remedial Gardening, and it's exactly that. It's a whole very long checklist, and you'd want to take your time about it. But it helps you ask yourself questions and walk through the garden and really appraise the role each plant might be playing. So before you just make a clean sweep, you start to say, well, wait a second, does that actually maybe screen something I don't want to see? Or is this a good windbreak? Or if this particular thing is past its prime, but it's still functional, maybe I should shave off half of it in the back and put a new young plant in and let that come up for 5 or 6 years, and when it's bigger, then I could take this old one out. So it's like learning to think about what you're actually getting from what you have. And it also talks a lot about ways to evaluate the state of health or beauty of the plants that you have in place, because nothing you put in young is going to measure up to what's there. And I think it's a mistake to just hastily clear away everything. But on the other hand, sometimes decluttering a garden is magical, because when you can take out the pieces that are irrelevant or aren't really serving anything, then you suddenly say, wow, I have canvas out here. The space is a lot bigger than I thought, and I could make a really different kind of shape. And both of those are valuable. But I think if somebody's not sure, it's a really good idea to get some help. Now, the problem is there's lots of people out there who are dying to help you who are quite sure that they know exactly what should be done, but they may or may not. So when you hire someone, it's a really good idea to ask for references and ask that you get to go see some gardens they work on or see gardens they've designed or restored. And that way you get a sense of how they work and what it looks like. That's really important because otherwise you can make some really sad mistakes. I mean, losing big old plants that could be wonderful can never be restored.
Yeah. The overactive plants in the yard. I'm always doing battle with Virginia creeper.
Right. One of the things to think about is, you know, if you have a choice about putting something in, you really want to say to yourself, okay, I've seen these on buildings and they're the size of a barn. Is this really something that's going to be happy on my little trellis very long? And if it isn't, you might want to scale down and say, this isn't a plant for me. I give a lot of plants to Habitat for Humanity and other kinds of groups that do inner city work where they're, you know, gardens with nothing in them, and they'd love to have some big plants. So sometimes it's a great way to just find that puppy a new home. And then choose something smaller scaled that's more appropriate to the site and the size. Sometimes it's not your plant. The Virginia creeper might be next door, and you don't really have that option. But you can try to figure out ways to at least incorporate it, whether it's adding trellis for it to climb up and give yourself a little more shelter, or just know that you have to go out once or twice a year and do some edging to make sure it doesn't invade your property. Also, sometimes there are big plants that are just totally in the wrong place, right next to the door, right next to a path. You do always have the option, which we forget, of moving a path. It's really not that hard. You can rent teenagers to come in and jackhammer up a cement path, break it up, take it away, and consider a whole new approach. If the tree or the shrub in the wrong place is actually very beautiful, sometimes that's really worth it, and it gives the garden a whole new look. Other times you might say, all this is a giant boxwood, and it looks ratty and silly. Why don't I just take this out? And again, you got canvas. Taking out a big old shrub that's in the wrong place can give you so much real estate. I don't like to have plants right up against the house where they often get diseased at the back. There's bad air circulation, and always it gets hard if you want to ever go in and paint, change a screen, and you're battling the plants. So usually I take out a lot of overgrown foundation plants completely, and again, these are great donation candidates for new gardens that have no plants.
Let's talk with a listener on line one in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing good. I'm the perfect person. I was listening to you describe my situation. My husband and I moved here recently, and we bought about 3 acres, and two-thirds of it is bordered by woods, and the person before us had every type of flower imaginable. I have two questions. I've heard somebody say that borax will get rid of Creeping Charlie. Is that true, and what's the recipe? And then secondly, we've got a circle drive with a large area in the center that I would like to convert over to some prairie grass or something that I don't have to mow, and kind of incorporate some more natural grasses and things to that would be, you know, complementary with the environment and the woods and that kind of stuff. So that's my question.
Okay. First, let's take the Creeping Charlie. I don't believe that borax would do anything good for your soil, and if you might want to consider whether Creeping Charlie might not be a perfectly acceptable ground cover for you. Sometimes, you know, plants that are doing real well are perfectly okay. They may be choking out small plants, in which case you might want to just upgrade the landscape a step and make it bigger things and not worry so much about the little bitty guys. Put those in pots, in containers, or move them to another area. Sometimes when a plant is flourishing, if it's doing its job, if it's being a good ground cover, it might be a great solution. If it isn't, then you want to consider what are you going to replace it with and stage yourself a replacement program, because if you just make bare earth, that's an invitation to weeds, and then you have a whole new set of problems. So it's better to take it area by area, figure out your long-term solutions, and decide if you want to replace that with another ground cover, what's the cost, what's the timeline, and otherwise you can almost make more trouble than it's worth. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I just, see, I don't mind Creeping Charlie, but my neighbor does, and there are areas where there are round bushes, and, you know, that's fine with me, but when it gets on the lawn, you know, he's kind of like, hey, you might want to get rid of that Creeping Charlie, and you know, so it's in the lawn that's a problem, and the person before us had a garden, and then she couldn't keep up the garden, and so it just is. I've got a whole big patch of it that's kind of amongst the grass,
right.
And that's something that the neighbor isn't crazy about.
But so it's your lawn.
It's my lawn, but it borders his, and I don't like to use a lot of chemicals, and so that was, something I was just wondering how. I don't mind towards the woods and stuff, but where it's close to his, I would, at least like to make an effort to cut it back a little bit in the
sure.
grass.
Sure. Well, one thing you can do, too, is remove it, spot remove it, as you go over time, give yourself a little bit at a time, and use a product called corn gluten. Corn gluten is a natural byproduct of making cornmeal. It's becoming much more widely available because it's really cool. One of the things it does is it won't let any seeds germinate. If you clear a patch and you make a slurry, it has to be wet to work, you have to start with it wet.
Mm-hmm.
So you wet some corn gluten and spread it over the cleared area. No weed seeds will germinate in that area. But it's also very high in nitrogen, 9 or 10, so depending on how it's formulated. So it will also let the grass grow back really quickly. So whenever you're weeding, pulling a weed out, you usually like pull a weed and all its babies germinate in its wake and you have 20 left behind 2 weeks later. This way, every time you pull a weed in an area that's ground covers or grass or beds or borders, if you use a sort of a little patch kit of corn gluten and water, you will not get any weeds germinating back in there. So that's a good way to kind of slowly get yourself out of a weed in the lawn situation. And again, it's available at many, many nurseries, and garden centers are now carrying corn gluten. So that's a great way to go.
Okay, and then my second question about a prairie grass or a ground cover, or I hate the lawnmower and the fumes and the whole process,
yeah.
And plus I've got a large area to mow. Is there anything that you would recommend for, it's a really nice circular area, and it's a couple of large pine trees and a couple of big, large rocks, and so it would be perfect for a natural grass
yeah.
or something to grow
great.
There.
I would recommend that you get a hold of your closest native plant society, call the local master gardeners, and they're usually available through your extension agent. If you look in the government pages, you can find County Extension Service and Master Gardener programs, and they're free, and they give free advice. And one of the things they'll be able to tell you is how to get in touch with your local native plant society. And that's where you get great plants very inexpensively, and you could start creating your own pocket prairie, which would be pretty neat. Now, one of the things to be aware of is that you do have to take out all the lawn and prep the way you would for any other kind of garden. Even though they're native plants and they are adapted to where we are, when we're bringing them into soil that's not like native sod and you're bringing them into a garden situation, you have to do the same kind of soil improvement initially, just up front, that you would if you were planting anything else. But again, this is a project you could stage for yourself. If it's a pretty big area, you could do a quarter of it or half of it at a time, so that you weren't taking on too much. And if you do want to just take up that sod, you could cover the whole area with straw, not hay, but straw, quite thickly, and let it rot down in place, and that will help improve the soil and keep any plants from coming into that area. Or you could also use that corn gluten, as I told you before, to keep it clean while you're waiting to do your prep and get plants in. And I like to take it projects kind of slow. Never take on more than you can actually finish at a time, because it can be so depressing to start a big project with all the right energy and enthusiasm, and have the weeds get there first.
Right. The weeds are fast. Okay, thank you very much.
You're so welcome.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other questions, comments, they are encouraged, invited. Here are the telephone numbers in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 1-800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. I don't know where all our gardeners are today. Generally, when I do a gardening show, the phone lines are just crazy.
Well, they're probably out in the garden.
Could be. I have a phone number for the University of Illinois Extension in Champaign County for that caller who just called in, and that number is 333-7672. And then at the farmer's market now on Saturdays, which has started up at Lincoln Square in Urbana, oftentimes I think that there is a group there that is a native plant society, and I think I haven't been to the farmer's market yet this year, so I'm recalling that the name of the group is Friends of the Prairie.
Oh, perfect.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Anne Lovejoy is our guest this afternoon, an award-winning garden writer. She's gardened around the world, and she's the author of many books on gardening. Her latest, Anne Lovejoy's Organic Garden Design School, Guide to Creating Your Own Beautiful, Easy Care Garden. Let's talk with another listener on line 4 in Vermilion County. Hello.
Hello. Yes, I did just come back in from the garden, and I've got to make a plug for our Illinois Native Plant Society. It is in Champaign County and Vermilion County. I have a phone number for it, and I have the email address if you would like.
That would be terrific.
The phone is 217, of course, 662-2142, and the email is ilnps@aol.com. We just had our first sale of Illinois native plants 2 weeks ago, and Grand Prairie, which is a different alliance devoted to pretty much the same thing, had their sale, I think, as you mentioned, just a week or so ago in Champaign. Ours was at the Forest Glen County Park, or mm-hmm. part of the Vermilion County Conservation District in Vermilion County, and we had a large number of plants and a goodly number of people that came.
That sounds terrific. And the name of your group again?
It's the Forest Glen Chapter of the Illinois Native Plant Society.
Okay.
And this was our first plant sale, and I am assuming we're going to have them in connection with Arbor Day. And anyone wishing to contact can find out the schedule of meetings and so on. And the state meeting is just coming up. The Springfield chapter, central chapter, have been having a plant sale for several years, and it's a big, a big plant sale.
I wonder what would be some great plants. I would think about Baptisia and some of the beautiful grasses and some violets and things. What would you suggest for our reader or our listener who wanted to have a pocket prairie?
We didn't have all that many of the prairie plants because at the time of our sale, they just really weren't all that out yet. We had ground covers such as the wild ginger and wild geranium and more forest plants of that sort. And in the prairie plants, the rattlesnake master, we had a lot of seeds of the summer prairie plants. I had a lot of golden Alexander, which take over nicely. We had, in damp spaces, we had the pink false dragonhead. And then, of course, the rudbeckia and echinacea, coneflowers mm-hmm. of various sorts, and the brown-eyed Susans. And I just came in from looking at my cream false indigo and the wild quinine that are good prairie plants. And then we also did have the various types of milkweed, the Asclepias tuberosa, as well as the incarnata. That is the swamp milkweed. I was trying to think of another one that we had. And I like the prairie drop seed for grasses that are small, short.
Mm-hmm. Right? It's got a beautiful texture and great fall color.
Yes, it's just lovely. So, I think you'll find that many of our gardens have been taking advantage of the cool weather and the sunshine to go out and, in my case, to prune and so on. But.
Yeah, we had a quite a warm spell, and now today and yesterday, actually, it's been rather cool. So it's a great time to get out there this week and get into the garden. I want to thank the listener for her call this afternoon, and let me repeat that phone number that she gave us, 662-2142, and the email address, ilnps@aol.com. We talked a little bit about lawns, but not a great deal. What are your feelings about lawns? Does your garden include an area or areas of lawn?
Well, mine does not, but I'm in the Maritime Pacific Northwest where there are really no native prairie models, and there are our native grasses in this particular region are almost exclusively bog grasses. So lawns are very foreign here, and they are in many parts of the country. One of the things I really ask people to consider when they're thinking about lawns is to use grasses, a grass blend that's adapted to regional water distribution patterns. You know, where you have quite a lot of summer rain, then it makes total sense to have, and then that's in fact where you tend to find these beautiful prairie models. And you can do lots of different kinds of lawns. One of the things to think about, though, is that the model that's been impressed on us, this like hyper-green Kentucky bluegrass kind of lawn, is actually pretty environmentally destructive. And one of the things that starts to happen, too, is we create water hogs that are chemically dependent and can't really live well in our region without a lot of help. And once we start pumping chemicals into the lawn, we discover that the lawn roots get very shallow and that we are actually killing the biota, the living part of the soil that's in the top few inches. I'm a partner in a large nursery here in the Northwest at Bainbridge Gardens, and we just converted from a chemical department to a health department, and we're completely organic and have no more of the really destructive chemical petrochemicals. And one of the interesting things is that when I started to learn where I could recycle them, I called the moderately hazardous waste site nearest to us, and they said, well, we can take some of those things, but a lot of things, including most of the weed and feed products, are considered high hazard, and they have to go to another special distribution center, and they actually, you pay a fee of $10 a liquid gallon or $1.50 a pound to safely dispose of products that we're allowed to sell and use. And my staff was just appalled and frightened. And I think if more people were aware how dangerous some of those products are, they would not be using them with such abandon. But one of the good news is that you can actually have a really healthy, lush lawn with wonderful, deep, sturdy root system if you're just using natural care. Mm. And it's simpler in a lot of ways. One of the things you start to do is, you know, choose your blend of seed, of course, very carefully so that it's regionally appropriate, and mow high instead of a very tight, low turf like a golf course. That you want to mow higher, 3 or even 4 inches. Grass only needs about an inch of water a week, so if that's your natural distribution pattern, you probably don't need to really do much watering. And natural feeds actually build healthier root systems. A natural lawn can have 12 or 14 inches of root system. A chemically maintained lawn typically has about 1 or 2 inches, and obviously that makes it a lot less able to withstand stress. Doesn't that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. In this part of the country, we have a pretty rich soil, and our community sits in Zone 5, although our listening area goes quite a ways north and south. If you were gardening here, Anne, what perennials would you have on a short list for?
So many of the natives in your exact region are so gorgeous. And it always struck me as interesting that Chicago Botanic, which is a wonderful, incredible mm-hmm. botanical garden in the English Garden area, is trying to grow these English border beauties. And I keep every time I go there, and they don't look very happy because they don't really like your climate, which is a little robust for English plants. But I keep thinking, if that were mine, I would pack it with prairie beauties. I would use the baptisias. I would use the beautiful cone flowers like the white swan echinacea, which has that beautiful kind of droopy, gorgeous, elegant neck. They're very, very handsome flowers. Or purple cone flowers in various sizes are so easy to grow for you, and they just look awesome. And, of course, butterflies love them, and they bloom forever, and they even look great in the snow. The Joe Pye weeds have such great natural architecture and give you height at the back of the border. Baptisia is beautiful from the time it comes out of the ground. It has a great texture, beautiful flowers, white or blue, and then it sort of goes to this beautiful kind of bronzy copper in the fall. When you walk around the prairie, you can see them just, they're radiant. They look burnished. And they actually hold up well into and look fabulous in snow. So I love those plants with a lot of natural architecture. I would certainly use some of those. And on a more delicate level, I would think about the shooting stars, which do, you know, mm-hmm. are native to you. Lots of the little violets are native, and those are some of the first things to come up in the prairie. So that sequence of plants would be really easy for you all to start using. And some of the grasses, the prairie drop seed our listener mentioned, or the little blue stem has fabulous fall color, beautiful texture,
and they also hold well into the winter and look really cool in coming up through snow. I mean, I think that looking at native plant patterns helps us choose the really good ones. And one of the cool things is a lot of your natives, the prairie natives, have actually been kind of selected for their best horticultural forms. Ironically, most of that selection takes place in Europe. So we send our native plants to, you know, finishing school in Europe and then bring them back as border beauties.
Interesting. Anne, we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Anne Lovejoy has been our guest this afternoon. She's the author of many gardening books. Her latest is Anne Lovejoy's Organic Garden Design School, a guide to creating your own beautiful, easy care garden.